that over again. We're going to try to cover three chapters tonight, 8, 9, and 10, get that on the tape now. And the basic theme of this chapter, or these three chapters, is going to be why God is going to destroy Jerusalem. He takes Ezekiel there and he shows him step by step by step what these people are doing. And of course, Ezekiel keeps trying to mediate. What does God say?
It's too late.
A little bit late for that. They have reached a level. Now, he had told them this, and we'll cover this when we get there. But you remember in Leviticus chapter 18 and 20, he warned them there, don't do the statutes of the people in the lands. Keep my statutes, because the land is vomiting them out because they are doing these things. And if you do these things, what's the land going to do to you? It's going to vomit you out. And he also told Abraham, I can't let you have the land now because of what?
The
iniquity Amorite is okay, not yet full. And the same thing with Israel. God kept sparing Israel because the iniquity of Israel was not yet full. But he had told them, if you follow the customs of these nations, now that their iniquity is full, then the same thing that happened to them is going to happen to you. And that's really what we're dealing with here, is God is showing Ezekiel why Israel needs to be destroyed, or Judah needs to be destroyed. And then he gives some interesting applications that we will talk about as the lesson proceeds. So we're in the sixth year now. That's where it starts in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, right in the middle of the page. We're in the sixth page now. I put above it that verse, when did they go into captivity? Right above the sixth year?
12th year.
All right, in the 12th year. So 6 minus 12, or 12 minus 6?
6.
It's 6. So how many years till the actual destruction of Jerusalem?
6
more years. So even though he is doing these things in this chapter, he's sending out the 6 men that are armed to put people to death. Did that really happen in the 6th year?
No.
No, it didn't happen. So this is a vision of how it's going to happen. But it's not going to happen yet. He's going back to Babylon to preach these things. In other words, is there anything better than a graphic illustration to get you a little more excited or a little more intense in preaching? So Ezekiel is in the house. It says in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, he sat in his house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, and I read, where do the elders come in again? The answer is they don't. We don't know what happened here. He's sitting there talking with them. They're talking with him. All of a sudden, he's taken in Jerusalem, taken to Jerusalem in a vision. And many, many things happen. Of course, how long does it take for a vision to occur? You know, we really don't know, but probably it could all happen in the twinkling of an eye, because what does time mean to the Lord? Absolutely nothing. So Ezekiel is taken by a lock of his hair. Which means what? Because last time we saw Ezekiel, he didn't have any hair, right? He'd had his hair shaved and his beard shaved, and he'd cut up the hair and to illustrate the destruction of Jerusalem. Now he's got his hair back. He's in the house speaking with the elders sitting before him. And all of a sudden, the same individual that we read in chapter 1 has come back and is now taking him to brought me in visions, is how it's worded, visions of God to Jerusalem. And when he gets there, God takes him to the north gate of the inner court. Now, he's not in the inner court yet. The way this is laid out, he comes to the north gate. You remember how the temple was laid out? We had the inner court, which is where the Jewish men would go, and what would they do? That's where the altar was. That's where the laver was. Why did the men of Israel come into that place? To offer their sin offerings and peace offerings and sacrifices. Outside of that was another court, which was called the court of the women, because that's where the men and the women could be. And then, obviously, in the time of Jesus, there was another court, which is where the Gentiles could go. So he is not in the inner court yet. He is outside of the inner court, getting ready to go through a hole in the wall and enter into the inner court. Carl?
No, I was just going to mention the court of the Gentiles.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I hate it when I do that. Steal all you guys' thunder here. So he's in the outer court. And he gets to see a vision, and what he sees is the seat of the image of jealousy. Now, we have no idea what this is. We see similar things. You remember the king who went to Babylon and liked the altar so much that he got rid of the altar that was the Lord's altar, put it away, and put the altar he'd seen in Babylon there. Now, how would God feel about that? See, that's not according to the pattern. You remember God told Moses, and God, or Hebrew writer makes a big point of this in chapter 8 and 9, that every article in the temple was representing something in heaven. And now in the church, all of that which was represented is now in actual existence. Jesus is now in the most holy place, and the church is the holy place, and we are the priests who are ministering to God, giving these sacrifices, which the Hebrew writer says, the fruit of our lips and the sacrifices of doing good works to the people of God. So these people have now removed that, and they've also added something else. And again, we don't really know what the seat of jealousy is. We know it has to be tied to idolatry, because what is it that makes God most jealous? Remember Hosea? How did God use Hosea?
Spiritual adultery.
Okay, marry a prostitute, the woman commits adultery, has a child, another act of adultery, another child, Hosea, not his children. Then God says, now you know. Now you know how I feel. Because what that woman has done to you is what the children have done to me, the children of Israel, since the judges. And then you remember the cycle of the judges? Every time they go back to idols, then God punishes them. As soon as he punishes them, who do they cry to? Their idols? No, they cry to God, because they know God is the only one with the power to take care of it, but they just can't stay faithful to him. So, and now we have another thing, and that's in verse 4. And this is the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision that I saw in the plain. Now, remember that vision? First he sees a whirlwind. What's the whirlwind look like?
Fire.
Big fire coming at him. And then he sees the four living creatures. And next to the four living creatures are four what?
Wheels.
Four wheels. And the wheels are moving, which tells us that this is some form of a chariot. That's what most people call it. But it's some form of transportation. We have the four wheels on the ground. Then we have the firmament above the wheels. And then on top of the firmament, the firmament is what? A throne of sapphire. And on top of the throne, and it's interesting the way he words it, far above the throne is God. So he's on the throne, but he is above the throne. And so we don't picture him sitting, but we picture him above that, moving around as these living creatures are directed by the spirit that is in them. And so he sees that same appearance. And then he also meets with, and I think I skipped this earlier, but if you drop back up to that middle verse where it says in verse 2, there was a likeness like the appearance of fire from the appearance of his waist and downward fire and the appearance from his waist and upward, the appearance of brightness, the color of amber. So this is the same man that he met with. It's never identified as God, but we do see some things that would lead us to that conclusion, and we'll look at that as the vision comes ahead. So he sees this vision of the image of jealousy. Then at the bottom of page 1, he goes on to see, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary? So did God leave willingly? No, they drove him out. He wanted to stay. He wanted to be gracious. He wanted to be merciful. But they made me go from my sanctuary because of these great abominations. But then what does he say? You will see what?
Greater
abominations than these. And I'm kind of going quickly through the first chapter, because I want to spend a little bit more time in chapter 9, and then hopefully we can finish chapter 10 tonight. So he just keeps seeing a series of abominations. The first abomination is this seat of jealousy. Now he is told to dig through the wall, find the door, and now he's gone from the outer court into the inner court, which is where the altar and the laver are, just right at the door of the temple. And what he sees there is on the wall, every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel are portrayed on the wall. And this is a vision. It's not really there. This is just a description of what the children of Israel are bringing with them. And the reason I say that is because if you look in the next verse, which is chapter 8, verse 12, it says, "Have you seen what the elders of Israel do in the dark, every man in the room of his idols?" Okay, so each one of them has a room like this. And so what God has done is he's taken, because how many elders are there? What's the number? The Sanhedrin? 70 elders. And each one of them has a room full of idols, and all of the idols and all the abominable things that are in each of those rooms are now laid out for Ezekiel on the wall. So he's seeing every sort of creeping thing. Now, what did God say about these creeping things back in the book of Leviticus and Numbers? Unclean. You can't eat them. They are unclean. You're not to have anything to do with them. And then the abominations, the same thing. But how far away are the children of Israel from that? In their rooms. It's just funny how when God says something is wrong, what does that force people to do or make people think? Now, there must be something really amazing about this. Why would God say no? Don't kids feel that way kind of when their parents tell them they shouldn't do anything? There must be something really good about it. They don't understand. Is there something good about it? Is that why the parents tell them no? No, it's dangerous. There's something bad about it. Well, and then they say this in 8 verse 12, "The Lord does not see us because he's forsaken the land." What kind of an application is that? We drove him out of here. Now that he's gone, we can do whatever we want because he can't see us anymore. Is that a good attitude to have? And is it true? You know, these people fall away from the Lord and go back into the world, and they think somehow, well, God's cast me off, now I can do whatever I want to do. Is that how it's going to work? Well, Peter says they've gone back to the dog's vomit, and they've gone back to the pig's mire, and it's going to be worse for them on the judgment day. So don't think that you can move away from God and somehow that's going to, you can go back to the position you were in. You can never do that. Once you know the truth and you turn from the truth, how does God see you? Better or worse?
Much worse.
There's these people in the world who have never known him. And yes, he's disgusted with them. But when somebody comes into the church and is baptized and cleansed and made a child of God and then goes back into the world, and of course, can you lose that child of God designation? Do they stop being our brother when they go back into the world? No, they're still. And that's what makes it all the worse. So these people are thinking, the Lord can't see us now because we've gotten him out of here. We can do whatever we want to do. Then in the next verse, chapter 8, 13, he sees some women. Now we're back outside of the north gate, where we've moved back from the inner court to the outer court, which is where these women are. And they are weeping for an individual called Tammuz. I don't know how you pronounce that exactly. But I took some time. I tried to figure out who this person is. And there's some guesses. Why would they be weeping for this person?
Dead, maybe.
Well, no, this is a god. This is an idol. So why would they be weeping for the idol? Well, he could be dead, but actually it's because of some tragedy that occurred that... some of the commentators put forth Adonis, who is the god, the very handsome god of the Greeks, who is the consort with Venus, but things didn't work out. So because they didn't work out, what should we do for poor Adonis? Well, we need to cry for him because, boy, he didn't get treated well at all. And God's not going to be too happy with that. Virgil?
Yeah, there's a subtle truth involved in this. The women were sitting there weeping for this idol. We have got to be very careful with things that are not right. We do not want to saddle up to it or try to justify it or make it sound like it's okay in that sense, or it's a shade of gray. There should be no weeping about that. It ought to be. They ought to be dismayed also.
They ought to be disgusted. I mean, it's not even true.
Yeah.
But yeah, and we're going to touch on that later, because you remember in Romans chapter 1, it says that they not only practice these things, but what was the second thing they do?
They approve of those who practice
them. And that approval often makes you feel that what they're doing is right, which means you kind of vicariously feel along with them. So sometimes when you read about somebody who got cut off and they were angry and they killed someone, and you say to yourself, well, I feel sorry for that person because I know how he feels, because when I get in that situation, I might feel the same way. Is that a good way to think?
No.
See, and that's playing in. That should be disgusting to us. And if we read things like that, how did Lot feel when he heard things like that? Says it tormented and vexed his righteous soul, observing the wicked things, or hearing about the wicked things that these people were doing. And that's the proper response. And but these people, again, they've just moved right into it. Then he moves in the very middle of the page to, he says, have you seen these things? Turn again, you will see greater abominations than these. So now we go back into the inner court of the house, the Lord's house, at the door of the temple, between the porch and the altar. Now, where's that? Between the porch and the altar. What's the only thing left between the porch and the altar? Where the feet, where the priests were supposed to wash their hands and feet before they go in? Okay, the laver is there. So now he's right next to the laver, between the altar and the door of the temple, which is a place that only the priest can be. And of course, we know that Ezekiel was a priest. He was from the priestly tribe, so he had every right to be there. And so at the door of the temple, between the porch and the altar, there were 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord. Now, where should they be looking as they're getting? They're right in between the altar and the porch. What should they be looking to? They're about to go into the temple. They should be looking to the Lord between the cherubim. Where are they looking? They're looking to the east. And what are they looking for? They're worshiping the sun. Now, God did have the temple facing east, but it wasn't so they could worship the sun. It was representative. When you serve God, are things getting... If you face it to the west, what happens as the sun sets? Gets darker and darker and darker. Is that how God wants to represent himself? As closer, it gets darker and darker. So he goes the other way. And it's interesting because I think it's the third or the fourth chapter of Proverbs, it says the path of the righteous is like the rising sun getting brighter and brighter unto the perfect day. But these people have really twisted things around, and they are worshiping the sun toward the east. Now again, what are the only people who could be there doing that? It's the priests. Okay, it's the priests. And then in chapter 8 and verse 17, he gets to the final point. He says, is it a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here? Now, in the Ten Commandments, these are the first four commandments. What about the last six commandments? What do they regard?
Neighbor.
Okay, neighbor. So, is it a trivial thing for them to treat me like this with these abominations? They have filled the land with what? With violence. And they have returned to provoke me to anger. They put the branch to their nose. Now, I spent some time trying to figure that out. Anybody ever looked at this? How do you put a branch to your nose? What exactly does that mean? And there's two thoughts on it. One is that this is a way that they worship their idols, that they get a small sprig of some plant and they put it between their nose as a way but I think this is probably is more of an idiom. If I say they put their foot in their mouth, what do I mean? They said something they shouldn't have said, and now they're going to pay for it. What if you shoot yourself in the foot? Okay, same thing. So putting a branch to your nose may mean something like that. These people have gone far beyond, and they have put themselves in a position where I am going to act in fury, verse 18. So they've done something, and I really think that may be more to the point, because he's already dealt with the idol problems. Now we've moved to their relationship to their fellow man, and with the two put together, they've definitely put the branch to the nose. And so if we can shoot ourselves in the foot, or we can put our foot in our mouth, which are both not real, but they represent something, then I suspect this probably is the same, that this is something to do with they have put themselves in a position where there's nothing left for me to do but dump fury on them. My eyes will not spare them. I will not have any pity. Though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I'm not going to hear. Now, we go back to the judges. Again, how long has God been putting up with this? Ever since Judges chapter, remember they went to the promised land, they did really well, and then that generation died, and a new generation came along. What did that generation do? Went right back to the idols. So God put them into, he said, I'm not going to drive these people out anymore. They're going to be thorns in your eyes. They're going to be in your sides. They're going to create all kinds of problems for you. And every time the children of Israel get just to the point where God's going to really punish them, they start crying out to the Lord. What does the Lord say this time? Not going to spare? Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, he says, I will not hear them.
Okay, I will not hear them. And I will not have pity. And I will not spare. I'm going to act in fury. And so judgment now is decreed. And so we come to the next verse. And before we get there, I realize it's kind of cut wrong, this passage. The next passage should also be seen, but I'll come to it in a minute. But what can one angel do? What did we see one angel do in Isaiah? Okay, 185,000 a day. So now we got six of them. So Jerusalem got a chance? All right, so then we go to the next page, and he called in my hearing, saying, those who have charge over the city draw near with their deadly weapons. Now, this is an interesting concept, and I don't know, you know, we talk about God's providence, but how it actually is fulfilled, we don't know. We do know that Jesus says that every servant of God has what in the presence of God?
An angel.
Okay, now some people call it a guardian angel, and that's kind of a misnomer, but Jesus does say that that don't you cause these little ones to stumble, because their angels are in the presence of God. And then it's also stated in Hebrews that angels are ministering servants sent forth to do service for the people of God, for us. So, and when we get to the end of Daniel, we found that Gabriel and Michael were doing battle with certain nations, and they were in charge of being protective. So sometimes when you think about the providence of God, God can use some of his servants to actually intervene. And it's just a concept that the scriptures reveal to us. We're not usually thinking like that. When we think about the providence of God, we think that God just reaches in and does it all, right? But is that what he did when Peter was in prison? How did he get Peter out of prison? An angel came. When the body of Jesus was there, what was there guarding?
A couple
of angels. And when it was time for Mary to have a son, did God come tell her?
Angel.
No, an angel did. So the angels are doing some of these things. And so these six men, obviously they're not real men, so what are they? Well, they'd have to be angels, right? Messengers from God. And so those who have charge over the city, probably before they had charge over the city with their deadly weapon, they had charge over the city in protection, to protect it. And so suddenly, verse 2, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his battle axe in his hand. Now, if they're coming from the direction of the upper gate, are they going in or out of the temple? Now think about it, they're going out of the gate. So if you're going out of the gate, where are you headed? Back into the city. Now, the reason I say this, the reason this is important, is because very quickly, God's coming out of that gate too. God is in the temple on the cherubim. Remember in Exodus, God says, you make these cherubim on top of the mercy seat, and I will dwell in the midst of or above those cherubim. So that's where God dwells. And it's interesting, when he leaves the chariot, or when he leaves Jerusalem, what's he on top of? he's off. He's on top of the cherubim. Because now we identify those four living creatures in chapter 2. And at the very end of chapter 10, I'm sorry, chapter 1. At the very end of chapter 10, it says they were cherubim. So when God leaves the temple, he rides away on the cherubim on that throne. But before that, he was in the temple. Or he was in the above the cherubim. And so the glory of the God is going up. See, this is in verse 3, the second verse there on top of page 3. The glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple. So the threat, now remember where he is. Is he in the holy place or the most holy place? Where are these cherubim? Okay, they're in the most holy place. So now God's on the threshold of the temple, so where's he gone? He's gone from the most holy place into the holy place. And he's getting ready to walk out the door. This is the final step. His fellowship is removed. But before that, we have these six individuals, and they, suddenly six men, came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with a battle axe in his hand. One man among them was clothed with linen and had an inkhorn at his side. Oh, I'm wrong. Johnny's right. Okay, I apologize for that. I was thinking they were going out, but where are they now?
Beside the bronze altar.
Okay, so if they're beside the bronze altar, where are they? If they come from the north gate and you get to the bronze altar, which way are you going?
In. Okay.
So you're going in. So, see, even preachers can make mistakes. And the humble ones can smile and say, I was wrong and Johnny was right. And we can be forgiven and move on, right, with a public confession here. All right, so here the situation now is that God's at the threshold. These inkhorn or these riders have come, or these people with the battle axe in their hands have come, and then there's another man, and he's clothed in linen. Now, if you're clothed in linen, are you getting ready to do battle? No. So he's clothed differently, and what does he have by his side? A battle axe? No, he's got a rider's inkhorn. So now God is on the threshold. And these nine men, or seven men are in front of him, the six men with the battle axes and the one man with the inkhorn. And so God says in chapter 9, and now I want to slow down a little bit and spend a little bit of time on this, although not much. Man, I went fast and it's already 8 o'clock. So can we have about 20 minutes extra tonight so I can finish that?
Talk faster.
Not going to happen, right? How about till midnight? I could really do a lot if we could stay till midnight. All right. So let's have somebody. Virgil, you're looking up. So why don't you read Ezekiel 9, 3 and 4. It's about the third verse on page 3.
And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it.
Okay. So this is the definition of a righteous man. This is the definition of a righteous woman. Now, when Abraham heard that God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, he started on a process of bringing God down lower and lower to finding what? In Sodom. If you can find 50, if you can find 45, 40, 30, 20, 10, what was he hoping to find? Okay, righteous men, right? Righteous men. God, Abraham says, if you can find 50 righteous, what will you do? What does God say? I'll spare the city. How about 45? I'll spare it. How about 40? How about 30? It's interesting how Abraham does this. If he'd only gone down to one, if you could find one, because that's all it was, then he could have spared the city. But I think he was hoping there were. But anyway, the definition of a righteous man would be someone who sighs and cries over the abominations. And that's exactly what it says about Lot. We talked about this earlier, so I'm not going to spend much time on it again. But he sighed and cried. He was oppressed. He was vexed. He was disgusted. Then the other side of the coin, those who approve of those who practice them, are they vexed? Are they sighing and crying? No, they're approving. And so this is something that is of great concern to us. When we go watch a movie, and let's say it's an R-rated movie, and we just say, well, I know when they're doing these things that they're not real, but if you can sit there and watch things like that and not get disgusted and leave, what is that telling you about your character?
Compromise.
See, you are consenting with those who are practicing them, because when it comes time to count up how many people like the movie and whether we should keep making movies like this, what do they use? people who went there. And if you're one of those people, then you're accentuating the problem. Now, it's a minor point, but it's a point that needs to be made. When we're reading things in the paper, when we're seeing things that are going on, if it doesn't make us sick, if it doesn't oppress us, if we're not sighing and crying over it, then are we going to get this mark? See, we won't get the mark. So if God decides to do this again, we're not going to get the mark. Carl?
We used to have a saying that it's like putting your name on, signing your name on a bad check.
Yeah, well, and that's right. That's right. And Virgil brought it up earlier. When you're weeping, that means what? You're taking fellowship in it. You're having fellowship in it.
Yes.
And that's the problem. What did Paul say in 2 Corinthians chapter 7? Actually 6. Have no fellowship with the works of darkness. Now, we often think, well, that means I'm out there doing it with them. But isn't it fellowship if you don't rebuke them, if you treat them like there's nothing wrong with this? So that's what God is portraying here. And so then after that mark is placed in chapter 9, and again, I guess we're not going to have time like I'd hope to go slowly. Let's just kind of keep rushing on here, see if we can get through chapter 10. So go after him through the city. Don't spare, have pity, utterly slay old and young men, maidens, and little children. Now, why the little children? We know that little children, are they sinners? No, but we also know how quickly does the heart get set so that when they grow up, they're going to be little sinners. About 6 or even earlier. And so when God sent Israel into the promised land, did they give a limit? Did they say, don't kill this? No, utterly slay. Man, woman, infant, suckling. Because, as we've noted so many times, God can separate this on the judgment day. You want to leave these people to grow up and have this wickedness perpetuated. So, and then, verse 7, defile the temple, fill the courts with the slain. And at this point, in chapter 9, verse 8, Ezekiel is begging God. He's pleading with God. Will you destroy all the remnant of Israel and pouring out your fury on them? I fell on my face and... And God tells him in chapter 9, verses 9 and 10, the iniquity of the house of Israel is great, exceedingly great. The land is full of bloodshed. The city is full of perversity. They say the Lord has taken the land. The Lord does not see. But as for me, I will not spare them. I will not have any pity. I'm going to recompense them. Now, you remember how he addressed Jeremiah? Jeremiah was praying for the people. What did God say?
Stop praying.
Quit praying for these people. And he keep praying for him, and God would keep saying, quit praying for these people. I'm not going to hear your prayer. And I don't know what we would do. I mean, does God want us to have pity? I mean, if America's about to fall, who else is going to pay in this? My kids and my wife and my children and all my brethren. So do I want America to fall just to kill all these other people off? Well, I'm going to keep praying. And if God says don't, well... It's going to be hard. That would be a hard thing to do, wouldn't it? Okay, Carl?
Well, I think you and I discussed this once before, but this is a situation where these people knew God's commandments, and they were in total rebellion.
Right.
And that's why he said, don't pray for these people.
Right. They were hard-hearted.
Yes.
But still, wouldn't you pray, Father, please, something could happen? I pray this a lot. Pray that something could happen to change the hearts of these people. But what does God know? There's nothing left to do. I've done everything I can do. I've sent this nation to come in and conquer and take half the people away. And what are they saying? He's gone now. We can just do whatever we want to do. I mean, did that help? So... All right, so, and again, and I'm not going to read this right now, but this was the exact warning God had given in those passages at the very bottom, Leviticus 18 and 20, and we already talked about that. So let's jump to page 4. So the next thing that happens is the guy with the ink cord comes back and says, I'm done. I've already put the marks. I'm done. And now, at this point... He sees that chariot again. He sees that vision of the wheels. And he hears to the man that had the linen. In other words, the man started out as being the one who would do mercy, now we're back to judgment. So he tells this man in linen to go in among the wheels under the cherub and fill your hands with coals of fire and scatter them over the city. Now, are these good coals of fire, you think? No, this is another form of judgment. So the man of linen, he goes in there, he stands beside the wheel. He doesn't reach in, though. In verse 7, the cherub stretched out his hand among the cherubim to the fire that was among the cherubim and took some of it out and put it into the hands of the man clothed in linen. Then we get another description, and I'm not going to take the time to read it, but I bolded all these terms because this is the exact same image that he saw in the very beginning. So this is the exact same image, except now these cherubim are identified. And look at verse 15. This was the living creature I saw by the river Kibar. Except there's one interesting change. In the first chapter, it's the face of a man, an eagle, a lion, and an ox. Here, it's the face of a man, a lion, an eagle, and a cherub. Now, does that mean a cherub looks like an ox? Said it looked like a living creature? I don't know. There's no way to know. I kind of doubt it. I really don't think God's going to depict a cherub like an ox. But the problem we have here is that this is the living creature I saw. Look at chapter 10. This is the living creature I saw under the God of Israel by the river Kibar, and I knew they were cherubim. So, now we learn, remember back there, we didn't know who that person was with the fire in the legs and the amber, or the other way around, whichever one it was. And now we know who was that. Well, it says here, it was the God of Israel by the river Kibar. So we look at chapter 10, verses 18 and 19 as we finish this out. The glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. All right, so the cherubim are now out of the temple. They're outside. The glory of the Lord is now above those cherubim, and he's outside. Then the cherubim lifted up their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels were beside them, and they stood at the door of the east gate, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. So where is he now? He's back on the chariot. He's left Israel, he's left the temple, and his presence is no longer there. So, and again, this is all a vision. I don't know how much of it we should take literally, but I think that it's a good idea for us to envision this, because this is how God expresses that that this was his final leaving of the temple. Now, when's he come back to the temple?
When they rebuild it.
Okay, long time. Long time. All right, we go ahead and stop there. And we did finish up to chapter 10, so next week we can jump to the next level and deal with a little more of this. All right, thank you.